We are going to run another marathon. Run away from Satan. So take heed that no man deceive you.
We are going to run another marathon. So run away from tears and tribulations of this struggle.
Welcome to another episode of the Cambridge Endurance Sports Podcast. Today I'm chatting to the great Charlie Wartnaby, Cambridge running legend, marathon specialist and self-confessed running nerd. Lots to learn from Charlie. Sit back or carry on running or pedaling, doing whatever you're doing, and listen carefully. Enjoy Charlie Wartnaby.
Just do it right and be commends.
Right, I'm here on a rainy Monday in Milton Country Park with the legend that is Charlie Wartnaby. How are you doing, Charlie? Have you been for a run today yet?
Oh, Ben, I have, but it was a pretty sad run. I've done my back in a bit, so I kind of jogged in to work at 11-minute miles, 2.5 miles, to loosen it up.
Cool, that's like a backyard ultra pace, which I've been talking to Dom about in the previous episode. But so what age are you now, Charlie, just if you don't mind telling the world?
I'm 53.
53, so you're catching me up. And yeah, but you still manage to get what kind of weekly running totals do we talk about these days?
Well, kind of between marathons, you know, maybe I'm a bit rudderless. I never know how to train between marathons, but I'm doing maybe 40 miles a week.
Okay, that's
but
nice.
But just in bits and bobs, yeah.
Yeah, and do you usually try and include a long run?
Yeah, I mean, it tends to be not so long out of marathon season, but on Saturday, for example, I did a park run sandwich. So that's a total of 17 miles with an Eddington park run in the middle.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they? Yeah, that's a good workout, that is, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so let's go back. Where did it... before that, I want to know, because a lot of people will have come across you in maybe slightly unusual ways, like seeing you scraping things out of shoes or probably seeing your results on where you've been a member of CNC for a long time, I know. But how would you describe yourself as a runner? What kind of a runner are you? And how would you... If someone said, what kind of a runner is Charlie Wartnaby, what would you expect them to say?
Oh,
what would you want them to say?
I suppose I'm kind of a veteran marathon specialist and a bit of an experimentalist and a fading specialist at that, I guess, but yeah.
Specialist in terms of being a marathon runner.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I try and optimise my performance for the marathon, and I don't really know what I'm doing for shorter distances, but I do them anyway as well.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting that you said that, actually. I was thinking you might have alluded more to your let's say analytical approach to you, because would it be an insult to call you, I mean these days I think the word is used positively anyway, but in my day it was not used positively, but would you call yourself a running nerd?
Oh, totally, yeah, nerd, geek, yeah, all of these things, yes. I'll be flattered if you call me any of those, yeah.
And what came first, geekiness or running in your life?
Oh, almost simultaneous. I've been running for a long time and I've always been a geek, so
yeah, right from school. Yeah,
absolutely, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
And tell us then, where did you grow up, first of all? Are you a Cambridge boy or not?
No, I started off life in a place called Oxted in Surrey, next to the North Downs. So my school cross-country route took us up onto the Downs, which is quite tough. And there was actually a geography teacher, rather than a PE teacher there, called Mr. Manson from up north, who encouraged us to do a lot of running. So, he actually got me, with my mum, to do my first marathon when I was 13.
Wow.
So I managed to find a race where children were allowed, if accompanied by adults. So
so you've been doing marathons for 40 years?
Yeah, I did have a bit of a career break, because I didn't do another one until I was 39.
Fair enough.
But, yeah, so I kind of followed in the footsteps of my mum. She took up marathon running in middle age, and I always thought she was kind of excruciatingly, embarrassingly eccentric. And I do pretty much what she did then, now, myself, so maybe,
really?
Maybe I'd embarrass my kids in the same way as she embarrassed me, I don't know. So
straight into the long distance stuff, really.
Well, after that marathon, I didn't do anything that long again for a long, long time. I did actually kind of run my newspaper rounds, which got me fit.
Yeah.
But just odd bits of school cross countries and stuff, on and off at university, not very consistently. But I did do some cross country racing at university. I was in the college club and stuff.
Right. So did you think of yourself as a runner already or not?
Yeah, off and on. Yes. Yes. But I didn't really start more solidly until I was getting towards the V40 age group. And that's kind of a conscious thing, you know. So when I was like 38, 39, I realised I was going to become a vet, and I thought,
By which time you're in Cambridge?
I was, yes. Yeah. Sorry, I've skipped out a few years in between. Yeah. Yeah, so I came to Cambridge as a student and I'm a hanger-on. I've just never left.
Like me, yeah. Ah, interesting. Yeah. So did you, when you got back into your running, what prompted that, and did you join the Cambridge and Coleridge straight away? Or?
Not straight away, no. So, I'd done kind of odd bits in the intervening years where I just, you know, ran occasionally or in brief bursts. But then, yeah, in this solid thing from maybe when I was 38, 39, I got up as far as doing some marathons and stuff. But to be honest, I only joined CNC for the vanity of the championship start at London. When I finally qualified for the championship start, you could only do it if you were in a club. So I thought, oh, I better join a club.
Right. But, for those who don't know, did you do that by going under 2:45 or?
Yes, it was 2:45 then. So it's got tougher now. It's now sub 2:40, and yeah. I can't do that anymore. I'm too old and too slow. So,
so what age were you when you did that the first time? Then you
got... it's when I was 40. So it's the 2010 London Marathon, and I was kind of pegging it down the mall. I knew about this 2:45 time limit. I could see the clock ticking up in the 2:44s, and I made it by 13 seconds.
Brilliant.
So just squeaked in. Yeah.
And, of course, since then, you've done the London Marathon how many times?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's every year since then, except the 2020 one, when it was only Elite, although I did the virtual one. So 13 times, I think.
Excellent. And many other marathons apart from
that. Oh, absolutely, yes. So my claim to fame was I did 10 consecutive championship starts and 10 consecutive sub-2:45s. But the last was by only 4 seconds and was so painful at the end.
Which year was that?
It was either 2018 or 2019. I'm losing track.
Right, so you were nearly 50 then.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
So you haven't done it as a 50-year-old?
No, I did this year. No. In fact, the last couple of years. So, because I'm now 53.
No, I mean under 2:45.
No. I think maybe 2:47 might have been my best at Bedford Autodrome.
Okay, that glamorous place. Yeah. Yes. Well, I've done very few marathons, but one of those was in Luton, so I think that trumps Bedford even.
Fantastic.
So let's talk about that then. I mean, we'll go into the details of your training and things shortly, but let's pick out the highlights of your marathon career then. If you had to pick out your PB and the ones that you think you race the best, let's have two or three highlights.
Sure, yeah. So, well, my PB was 2:38:30, actually in the York Marathon, or Yorkshire Marathon properly. I did that a few times because both my kids went to York University, so it's like an excuse to do it. But my best marathon wasn't my PB. Matthew Slater knew it was my lifetime run before I did. He knew immediately. Okay, so the 2018...
This is another CNC runner, by the way.
Exactly, and he's now doing a PhD in marathon pacing.
Is he?
He's very generous with his pacing duties for other people. Oh. So... He's
doing an actual PhD.
He is, yeah, Anglia Ruskin, with Dan Gordon, and I volunteered.
Great, you can do a PhD.
In fact, I volunteered for several studies Anglia Ruskin, but come back to.
So you're saying he knew it was your day.
Exactly. So 2018 was the year it was really hot, and I felt guilty because so many people had such a miserable day. There were people in tears at the end who I knew, and I was thinking, actually, that was great. I remember going past a DJ at like 18 miles or something playing Robbie Williams, and I had Let Me Entertain You in my head for the remaining miles, which just felt fantastic. Yeah. My claim to fame there was that at halfway, there were over 300 people ahead of me in the field. By the time I finished, I was 140th, so I overtook more than half the people ahead of me because so many people had such a bad time. And my secret is external cooling. So I spray water over myself a great deal in hot weather in races, and that makes all the difference. And I'm quite little and scrawny as well, so that's good for heat loss. So I think that's how I managed to overcome the heat in that one when so many other people had such a terrible time. And I did do some DIY saunas because we knew the weather was going to be hot. So I kind of turned my shower at home, my shower cubicle, into a sauna. Mm-hmm. I did some overdressed running as well, which is a thing that Christoph Schwiening, another CNC legend, he kind of encouraged us to do, and had a lot of salty food, so I did everything I could to acclimatise to the conditions.
This is all very familiar stuff for triathletes who often have to race in for a long time in the heat. These are the kind of protocols that they're very into. Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't gone for anything more technical than just spraying the water. I mean, you can now get special caps with which have like a gauze on them, which has a cooling effect. And you know,
well,
you can
funnily enough,
ice under the cap, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, I did threaten my family with
having
making
ice cubes before you start, or this sort of
thing. That wouldn't last long. But no, I did threaten my family that I'd make a hat out of washing up sponges, so that would be much the same effect.
So we've got the 238.
30, yes, that's my PB when I was 46.
In New York. And then your greatest day was London, 2018.
Yes, so that was actually 2:39:22, so it was nearly a minute slower, but I was 48 by then. And to be honest, I've been going downhill ever since. So that was the best one. I did two or three times I got to wear an England vest, but it wasn't like a proper England vest. It was one of those ones where they get a busload or even two busloads of veterans with very easy qualification standards to have a kind of representative race. So I did those in York.
It's all
and Chester
relative
as well.
I think they're not as easy as you say. You know, they're easy to someone. They're easy for someone who's, you know, an elite runner, but they're not easy for the thousands who are below that level. You know, so don't do yourself down on that. Let's just hear then. What was that? What distance was that at?
That was also marathon.
Marathon was it?
So, yeah.
But you've done some decent. I mean, you're not a great sprinter like me.
Absolutely.
But you've done some decent other races. What about a few other little highlights then over the years?
Yes, well, I mean, half marathon, my PB is 1:14:33. Mm-hmm. And I was actually quite inspired by you because you got that 72-minute run at Peterborough. And I went to Peterborough too, I think, because you'd showed me what a 40-plus guy can do. So, but I never managed to get quite down to that level. 10K was 34:14, I think, in St Ives.
Oh, yeah. Or you go up and then come back down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's always either windy or hot or both, or was for that course, which is no longer.
But you're a prolific racer. Have you bothered working out how many races you've done?
Oh, gosh. I have got like a web page with all of my races listed.
And I'll just say to the listeners to go onto this page, tell us what it is.
It's www.wartnerby.org/running.
Yeah, and you've recently added a lot to it, haven't you?
Yes, well, I always add when I have races, and then it's also got links to particular things I've done. And the reason I mentioned it is I have started tallying marathons and ultras. So I know it's like 41 marathons, but I haven't done shorter distances. I don't know, it's got many hundreds of rows in the table there, though.
Yeah. We might as well just talk about your website now, because you've started cataloguing age group best times for Cambridge and Coleridge, haven't you?
That's
over
right.
The years, yeah, from the various age groups and the various distances,
Yes, so it was maybe a bit of a gap that our club, you know, I suppose it's based around the track, and so we maintained track and field records, but there was no kind of proper record of road running performances. You know, nobody knew for sure who'd done the fastest marathon or half marathon or 10 miles. So as a starting point, I wrote a script, being a geek, of course, being a nerd, to scrape data from Power of 10 and Run Britain, the national database sites, looking for Cambridge and Coleridge performances and then tabulating them by age group and different race types and so on. So I've just got kind of a prototype of that on my website, but the idea is to then merge that with known historical records that predate the Power of 10 to come up with an official final list.
Fantastic, and you've got quite a way with it, haven't you?
Yes, it's certainly a big file, and because it has several places for each five-year age group, then there's almost something for everyone, and I'm sure you're all over that, Ben. But yeah,
we definitely feature. So do you. Yeah, and of course, we probably see, I wonder what other names come up a lot from our sort of age group. Does Peter Thompson feature?
Oh, yes, when you get down to the shorter stuff, like,
yeah,
you know, 5,000 metres and 5K.
Yeah,
and John Anderson, Andrew Shields, even Glynn is there.
And of course the new crop, though, are getting older, aren't they? That's the problem. Like Sullivan Smith, who I hope to
get
on here at some point.
Yes, I think he had a cracking performance in the kind of club mob match the other day at Debden Airfield.
So we'll gradually get pushed out. But then,
yes, exactly.
Were your marathons with carbon shoes your best ones?
No, actually. My PB was before the carbon shoe era. By the time I adopted them, I think my performance was declining, even in age-graded terms, and the shoes didn't rescue me from that. So
Although you did some part of your nerdness, and in, it's on your website, I think, isn't it? You did these experiments. You did like a test with your... I'm not sure about the... Totally sure about the protocol, but we'll go with it. And I think it gave you a small advantage, didn't it?
It did, yeah. So I tried running a kind of alternate laps of the park, only looking at my heart rate. So I didn't let myself see what my pace was.
Yeah.
And I either used my normal shoes or the carbon shoes, and I did alternate ones for about 12 laps because I knew my performance would drift in the session.
Yes.
And afterwards, it was pretty clear there was about a 1% improvement using the carbon shoes.
Mm. Which would suggest that perhaps you're not the top end of the responders by any stretch.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Although my previous race shoes were already the lightest I could find. I'd chopped bits off to make them lighter.
All right, well, you've mentioned it now. Tell us about this. This is what will make you smile or laugh, because we'll talk about your training, as I say, in a bit, but you've looked to gain advantages in every possible way. So you talked about heat work and how to acclimatise to that. But you've also, lightness is going to make you go faster.
Yes.
And you've taken that to the extreme and Charlie's now picking up his shoe.
Absolutely. So I've got a hacked shoe here. It's a bit damp because of the conditions here at the country park.
So my shoes look like that anyway, but that's because I've worn them for too long. But
yeah. So I'm holding a Next Percent 2, which I suppose they retail at over £200 full price. And which is maybe why people are horrified when I get the scalpel out and start hacking lumps out of them. So the first thing I take off is that kind of spike at the back, the pointy bit.
So that's you're not concerned about the aerodynamic loss from that?
I think at my speed it doesn't make a great difference. And there are two other problems with it. One is you get your heels clipped by other people in races. Uh-huh. And the other is just going downstairs. They tend to kind of squish against the risers of the stairs, which I found really annoying.
And you don't, once you've scraped, do you then do anything to sort of seal it? Or do you, is it sort of firm enough?
Yeah, so... So for the benefit of the listeners, I've taken a whole slice off the back of this shoe. It's maybe about 15 millimetres of thickness is no longer there, which saves maybe 20 grams. It also means that my...
Which is quite a high percentage of the weight of the shoe, isn't it?
Yeah. At the same time, I know I'm losing some of the bounciness of the foam, so I'm thinking better elastic recovery through my Achilles, but maybe less from the shoe. And I should explain, I'm more of a kind of 4 foot runner,
right, which is important. Looking at what you've scraped there, because most of what you've scraped is at the back, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. So I land well when my outer midfoot, but yes, after I've cut all this stuff off, I learnt very much to my cost that the remaining foam is ever so slippery on wet surfaces. And I had a bit of a disaster coming down a hill in a race once and kind of tumbled slightly, and also things like, I'm so London specific, you know, these smooth stone tiles around the Cutty Sark and the London Marathon, those would scare me in the wet. So I've put daubs of shoe goo, this kind of shoe adhesive, on the exposed foam to make them grippy again. So that's my secret. But I did try to measure the efficiency of a pair of unmodified Next Percent against my modified ones. And disappointingly, they came out exactly the same. Although those were a previous pair where I've been rather conservative in how much I cut off. I've cut much more off than these.
Were you not taking foam out of the old types of shoes as well?
Yes. I used to sometimes kind of scoop chunks out of the heel, but kind of leave it around the edge. So I kind of changed my methods with time. But I did that to some lunar races long ago.
They were light, really light to start
with,
weren't
they? Yes, but they were very squishy at the front. And I like that. So I like a good squishy front, but the heel... You know, I'm not much of a heel striker. I mean, my heel does touch the ground as I go through mid-stance, but I never really kind of land on my heel.
Yeah.
And also my Asics Hyperspeeds, I used to similarly chop the heels off. So they were my previous race shoes.
Well, have you met anyone else who's done that?
No. I can't say I have. I've been asked by complete strangers to show them my shoes. Yeah.
We must take a photo of this afterwards, actually, to put on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's great. And you'll keep doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, the other attention to detail here is sometimes people ask me, why have I got a safety pin in my laces? And so I put that through the double bow during races so that the laces will never come undone during a race. It's just one of those superstitious things. But
That's great. You're not gone for the elastic laces then. You don't like those.
I tried those, but they pressed onto the top of my foot. So I was worried about getting extensor tendonitis, you know, when the top of your foot gets sore from tight laces. Consider them.
Okay, so let's talk a bit in detail now about sort of marathon preparations, but, you know, trying to make this a benefit to people who are maybe looking to do an autumn marathon as well. For someone who's not a beginner runner, for someone who's already, you know, knows they're going to complete the distance comfortably and so on. How long do you think is the ideal marathon build-up to get a peak performance? Or what's the minimum you you need from if you've just got a basic level of running fitness?
Wow. I suppose, well, personally, I never follow an official programme. I always do London, which is usually late April. And often I've started around Christmas time and then realise that that's too soon.
Right, because so, mentally or physically?
Physically. I think sometimes I've maybe peaked too early. Although I do have the intermediate target of your Cambridge half, of course. It's very important.
Yeah, which is the beginning of March.
Yeah, exactly. So so I suppose that would be all of January, February, March. So that's 3 months and part of April.
Yeah.
So 15
weeks, let's say. Yeah.
So maybe that's a little bit too long for me. Maybe maybe more like 12 would be better.
Yeah.
And I did start a little bit later this year, actually, and I think I felt better for it.
And do you follow a sort of traditional form of getting base miles in and gradually adding speed and race specific work in, or do you, have you played around with that and come up with something better?
Yeah, I mean, I've got my own formula, and it's just what suits my legs and my lifestyle, really.
Right.
So the first thing is I really like running my commutes to work. It's a great way of getting mileage in, and it's just convenient and it fits in with life. I get to run along the river as part of my commute, which is, I feel I'm really privileged to do that.
Mm.
But that means that my legs are always a bit knackered during the week. And so I never really want to do like club training sessions or anything. Because the other thing is that my muscle recovery is terrible. I mean, some people just can't believe this. I mean, I'll name check Neil Tween, who can run any distance at marathon pace, and the next day he is absolutely fine. I can't do any kind of decent run without feeling it for days afterwards. So I basically have to taper before I can do any decent training.
Right.
So I need like a day or two off before I do a big training run at the weekend. And so I've ended up doing all of my quality in my long run. For me, my long run is my quality day, and I don't do any fast stuff during the week. I did sometimes when I was a bit younger, like early 40s, but now I just don't even try and do that.
Not even as you get nearer to race day?
Oh, well, the taper week, maybe I should get on to taper week later, is special.
So, we've got a 12-week build-up.
Yeah.
Would you be increasing mileage week on week?
Yeah, it's a bit random. I mean, I just... partly influenced by Christoph Schwieninger a few years ago. I just try and fit in as much as I can or as much as my legs will take. And I suppose...
Not worrying about pace at all?
Not really, no.
No?
No. Except during my long runs, if I want to do a good job of those. But I am a real long run nut. And I was converted way back in, maybe it was 2009, 2010 or something. I wasn't running a lot of miles then at all. I was on a fairly low mileage campaign. But I did do two full marathons in training, so 26-mile training runs.
Mm.
And my experience was transformed. It's the first time I'd done like a nice, even-paced marathon race. So ever since then, I've always done training marathons. And I think that's partly because...
How long before the target race?
Oh, the last one, usually 2 weeks out.
Only 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I know people, fret about whether they should still do 20 miles, 3 weeks out.
Yeah.
But I was influenced there because I did... two marathon races 2 weeks apart during lockdown, so I did a slightly half-hearted one on a runway because I wanted to get a safe qualifier for London, and then I did a much better one at Bedford Autodrome 2 weeks later, and that showed me that if I didn't completely go for it in the training run, that I would actually maybe benefit in the race from having done a recent marathon. So
I think the stimulus is interesting, isn't it? I mean, obviously, you're saying you need recovery time from a little bit of quality work, and yet you can run a marathon before 2 weeks later. So it's a different type of recovery, isn't it?
Exactly. I know that sounds paradoxical. But and the full training runs, I think it's partly a physiological thing that I want to promote fat burning, glycogen sparing, all of the standard stuff.
Mm.
And some people just naturally do that anyway and don't need to do such long runs or they do so much other running that they're always running glycogen depleted. But for me, doing it in one big run really works. But also just psychologically, that you get used to a marathon being a normal distance.
Yes, I think that's the big one. I think the psychological benefit is great, isn't it? And having that confidence.
Yeah, I sometimes feel that people think that doing the full marathon is like having sex before marriage in the olden days. You shouldn't. It's like a holy mystery that you should only encounter on the real day. And I totally disagree with that. Yeah.
Oh, great. I've never heard that comparison before. Yeah. You're talking there about fat burning and so on. And I'm guessing then you're not a high carb person in your nutrition strategy, or are you on race day?
On race day, I totally am.
Tell us how you do that then.
Okay.
Because I'm sure as a nerd, you've done this. Absolutely. How many grams of carbs are you taking per hour?
Oh, gosh. It's basically as much as I can handle. So I mean, about 2 weeks out from a marathon, sometimes I've done a bit of carb depletion, sometimes not. Mm-hmm. Up until about the Wednesday before a Sunday race, I might be carb depleting a bit.
Yeah.
I do all my training, I should say, fasted. So no gels, no breakfast, no energy drinks. All of these training marathons are completely without nutrition.
Just water, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And often no water as well, unless the weather's really hot.
I wouldn't advise that. As someone who's had kidney stones, I wouldn't advise that.
Okay. But race day, absolutely, totally different. So certainly on the Thursday and the Friday before a marathon race, I just start picking on loads of carby food.
Yeah.
Kind of malt loaf, low-fat biscuits and cakes, kind of thick sandwiches. I actually take stuff into work and get people to help me carb load, because I used to feel a bit self-conscious about just sitting there stuffing my face. But I finish that on the Friday. So on Friday, I'll be groaning. I've had loads of carbs.
Yeah, you feel bloated.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And that's why I want to get it out of the way. So on the Saturday before the marathon, I eat much more lightly. I only have refined carbs then. So normally I have loads of fruit and veg and fibre. That's all out of the window on the Saturday before a marathon. I only have white bread and jam, some cheese, maybe some crisps. No. That would be absolutely fine, yeah. But basically nothing that will leave any residue that might mean I have to make an unfortunate pit stop the next day. And eat fairly lightly. So it's still, you know, keeping my carbs topped up.
Topped up, yeah.
But not filling my, not getting kind of bloated with gut contents. So that's what my pre-race nutrition looks like. And on the day, I will have some bread and jam, not just a kind of small sandwich or bread and marmalade, and some coffee. In a big race like London, I'm careful not to drink too much in advance, because you can drink as much as you like while you're going round. There's bottled water everywhere. And the last thing you want to do is stop to go to the loo. So I don't try and pre-hydrate. You know, I just have like maybe a couple of mugs of coffee in the Travelodge or something like that. And then really nothing until I'm running. Yeah. and then I do have gels in races.
So let's talk about marathon gel strategy then.
Yeah. I've actually changed this because of an experiment I did this year. So I tried wearing a glucose monitor for 2 weeks. And the first day was a day I did a training marathon when I had no fuel, no breakfast, no nothing. And the last day was the London Marathon. So I learned from the training marathon that actually my blood sugar goes up when I start running, even if I've not been eating anything. It was a complete surprise. And it goes pretty high and stays quite high for maybe an hour. And it never drops particularly low. So that meant in the race now, I didn't really want to start taking gels until maybe about 10 or 12 miles, because I thought, there's no point earlier than that. I know that my blood sugar will be high anyway. After that, I still had the gels just in case they helped. And so I actually know that my blood sugar, even as I crossed the finishing line, was definitely elevated above normal levels, and it was higher than if I'd not had gels. So I have four gels. I like to have caffeinated gels.
All of them, yeah, not just the finish, yeah?
Yeah, actually, it was maybe two or three of the four this year. That was a bit random. I don't want to kind of overdose on caffeine, I suppose.
No, exactly, yeah, just different people react differently, don't they?
Yeah. And I don't want to have the last one too close to the finish either, because if you're still digesting it, it's not doing any good.
No.
So they're all kind of squeezed in, really.
Do you have a particular favourite brand of gel? Or do you
I quite like kind of dense ones. They're lighter to carry. So the goo one's very nice. Salted caramel, because I believe in having a lot of sodium if you're going to be sweating much.
Yeah.
So they're my favourite.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. And do you try and sprint for the line? Do you think?
Do you have
the sugar there available to do that?
Whatever I've got left. I mean, it's varied year by year. Sometimes I've managed to lift my pace at the end. Sometimes I've been in a bit of a sad way. My last sub 2:45 was absolutely agonising. I passed the 800 metres to go sign, so exactly half a mile, with my watch saying 2:42:00. So I knew I had exactly 3 minutes to do half a mile, 6 minute mile pace. By that time I'd been doing 6.5 minute miles and my legs were in a bad way. And somehow I just forced myself agonisingly to do it and somehow accelerated on these terrible legs. And I got through with 4 seconds to spare, got my last championship qualifier, but I've kind of almost fell over the line. You can see it in the official pictures. I'm kind of stumbling across the line. I was in such a bad way.
Which is unusual for Charlie, I have to say. As you'll probably see from the icon that goes with this podcast, Charlie's usually a very smiley runner. Is that is that a conscious thing?
Yeah, well, partly. And actually, Eliud Kipchoge is supposed to be a smiley runner as well. Yeah, and it's supposed to do him good.
It is supposed to actually have a physiological benefit.
Yeah, but I do enjoy it. You know, I feel it's, you know, I enjoy the events. And London especially, it's such a privilege. Marshals in races actually often say that I'm still smiling. I tell them I'm still grimacing, but maybe it's smiling, really.
Yeah, you do. I have to say, you do seem less stressed by runs than a lot of people. A lot of people are very worried about their performance and about if they're going to beat their club mate or if they're going to hit a certain time. You seem to be quite relaxed about it. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I am keyed up in advance, and sometimes I don't sleep too well before races. But once I actually get going, I suppose, yeah, I've only got myself to please. I'm too old, really, to worry about, you know, whether I'm going to beat people or beat a time anymore. So,
but do you see running as part of your identity, obviously?
Yes.
If it does go badly, does it bring you down? Or
not really. I know I've had so many good experiences in the past. You know, I can always just reflect on those.
Nothing to prove.
So I can be relaxed. Yeah.
Right. So let's make sure we've covered all the essential elements for a good marathon preparation. Then we're saying about 12 weeks. We're saying the long runs. Taking care of preparing properly for the conditions, whatever they may be. What about any other elements in the training that you think are essential to getting your best performance? Do you think hill work? Do you think anything else?
I do sometimes do some hill work, especially if I know I'm going to do a race for some hills. And for that, it's the descents I'm worried about.
Yep.
It's getting quadricep fatigue. And that can be a problem even with fairly flat marathons. So I've started doing more strength training for my quads now, trying sort of pistol squats and stuff. The long runs, I should say, after a day or two's break, those are usually my fastest pace of the week. So I'll often do a steady run, which, even if it's a marathon, it's not marathon pace, obviously, that would be a race. But it can be only, you know, less than a minute a mile slower and may have a chunk of tempo. Sometimes I've even done some reps as part of my long run.
Right.
So that's where it's all hidden.
Yeah.
But often not.
Anything else apart from when you do your commutes and your steady runs and your long run? Any other elements to your training that we haven't covered?
I do a little bit of strength work, but probably not as much as I should. So one day a week I'll do a few core exercises to try and keep my abdominal muscles in good shape and stuff to try and hold my form together.
And what about your peak mileage then in the times when you've done your best races? What sort of peak mileage have you got to, and do you think that's been part of the reason you've done well?
Yeah, I suppose following the Christoph Schwiening craze, I did do some campaigns where I had some weeks of 100 miles plus. I think my record was 120 miles. I'm not close to that now. I was more like 70 miles per week this year in my best weeks for London. But it does seem to work. Just doing huge miles, you can't really tell until race day. But as long as you taper properly on race day, it does seem to do the trick.
Well, I read an article yesterday that said for an over 50-year-old, just to maintain a VO2 max of over 50, you probably need to do 10 to 12 hours of aerobic exercise.
Wow.
This is a guy called Alan Cousins who wrote this, so we can blame him if it's not true. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I think the point is you need to do a lot once you get to a certain age just to even stay at the same level of fitness, let alone improve it. So although 100 miles is not something I would ever attempt, but then I would do other training on a bike or swimming or whatever. But if you're just running, then unfortunately you do have to get these big miles to get your big performance.
Right, yes, I'm glad you measured that in hours, because my pace is atrocious in training. You know, it's often like 9-minute mile commutes, stumbling along with feeble legs.
Sometimes with a rucksack, though.
Oh, nearly always with a rucksack, yeah. And I even write down what weight I'm carrying in case of future analysis. I do a little bit of biking as well, but it's mainly just on, quotes, rest days when I'm not running.
Yeah. Right, and you didn't just stop at the marathon, did you? You've done some things well beyond marathon length.
Yes.
And particularly you've done this Bob Graham round. Tell us about that and about any other ultra highlights.
Right, yes. So just in a nutshell, for anyone who's not heard of it, the Bob Graham round was invented by a guy who was 42 years old when he did it. And he covered 42 peaks in the Lake District in 24 hours. So it's a really well-known challenge route, starting and finishing in Keswick. Now, it just so happened, we've done lots of family holidays in Keswick, and I picked up the book that someone had written called Feet in the Clouds by Richard Asquith. Anyway, and I was suitably inspired and thought, I better have a go at this. So so I did, and it was really just like a personal thing. But I didn't do it like most other people do. So in general, it's run by people who live locally. They've got fell running buddies. They can run in pairs, run in groups. They can get to know the route. They can practice. But I didn't want to do any of that. I only visit the lakes and family holidays. So I did some solo recces in 2010, I think, so long before I did it. Kept all the GPX files and then just used GPS navigation when I finally did my Bob Graham round. And also, when I did it, I was completely unsupported. I just had a rucksack full of stuff. I just left the family rented holiday cottage at 3 o'clock in the morning or something, headed into Keswick town centre to the Moot Hall where it starts and finishes, did my round, disappeared for 23 hours and 8 minutes or whatever it was, carried everything I ate, used water from streams with sterilising tablets, and somehow managed to get round it. And I hadn't intended to make a video of it in advance, but I took a video snip at each summit after a while and then kept that pattern going. So I made a YouTube video of it, which has had a lot of views, and it means I've occasionally got recognised by strangers in the Lake District, much to the irritation of my children. So, yeah.
Brilliant. So did your round get certified then or not?
No. Well,
because
that's...
you have to have the people up there, don't
exactly,
you?
Exactly, yes. So
but was... even with the video evidence, they wouldn't do it.
Right. Well, there's a funny story because, yeah, the Bob Graham Society insists that you are witnessed going over every peak and so on. So they would never accept me to their society or their dinners. But they wrote to me saying, oh, the Bob Graham is being considered for the UTMB, the Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc points.
Series,
but we kind of need proof of how tough it is. Please, please can we use your GPX file? Which I allowed, but I should have demanded honorary membership, really.
Yeah, you should have got something in return, yeah.
But no hard feelings, but yeah.
And did you use a route that was already a sort of recognised route, or did you create your own?
I think I started with bits and pieces from other people. Also from text descriptions, I plotted stuff on the satellite view, which I hoped were paths, and sometimes they just turned out to be stream beds. And I did run at least once over every section in advance, and then I modified my route according to that. But I still, you know, didn't probably have an optimal line. Later, when I did the Borrowdale Fell race a couple of times, I realised that I was running very inefficiently in my Bob Graham round compared to what the fell runners in the know would do. They would just careen down slopes when I'd be following the official footpath on slippery rocks, for example.
Yeah. So it was 23 hours, 8 minutes.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. And what's the distance and the elevation change?
Right. It's the distance was about 65 miles or something. And the elevation change, it's sometimes slated as 8,000 feet. Sorry, 8,000 metres.
Metres.
So it's about the same as Everest.
Wow.
I think I maybe got a slightly smaller number, though I can't remember it. I'd have to check my Garmin Connect or Strava recording, which of course I have. But
it's not something we'd sell someone to just go for a holiday in the Lake District and do without seriously looking into your video.
Absolutely.
And the routes and the training. It needs some recces, doesn't it?
Yes. And as a Cambridge guy,
my
specialist thing was running up and down the Grafton Centre car park stairs for 2 hours at a time. And that was entirely to prepare my quadriceps for descending mountains. Because otherwise that's so hard in Cambridge. And that's what kills you. So, has to be said...
You made a video of that as well.
It's in my video.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Afterwards, it has to be said, I felt like I'd been run over by a freight train. I couldn't really do anything useful for the rest of the holiday. So it did take something out of me. But it's nice to have on my running CV.
Sure is, yeah, yeah. Not many. How many people have done that? I mean, I wonder how many from Cambridge have done it.
I don't know. The numbers are clocking up.
Yeah.
So
it's because there's a trend towards
more
ultra
it's more popular
stuff.
Than it used to be. And some of the paths that used to be undiscernible on the ground are now, you know, kind of getting better trodden. So
it's getting easier, isn't it? It's like these carpentries. Everything's easier.
Yeah.
You mentioned another long distance race there. Was that not a long one?
The Borrowdale Fell race. Yeah, I completely under. So this is again a thing I did during family holidays. So it actually goes on past the Bob Graham route. It's only like 17 miles or something, but it climbs about 3 mountains, and I seriously underestimated it the first time. It took more out of me than a marathon, and took me much longer than a marathon, over 4 hours. So, but it was just an experience to do it, and I made a video of the second time I did that as well, just because it's such a beautiful thing. But yeah, it's absolutely kind of crazy, kind of being amongst other runners, careening down scree and wet mud and fell and stuff. I got overtaken by Nicky Spinks, who is a sort of legend of the formula. So yeah, no, it was an experience, but I was in no way competitive, not with anyone. But yeah.
So any other races, ultra or not ultra, that you pick out as being like your favourites over the years, apart from the marathons?
Yeah, I mean, when we had Wings for Life in Cambridge.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In advance, I thought, oh, that sounds like a bit of a gimmick. When I actually did it, I thought it was wonderful. I loved it. So that was a race in which there's a defined route and we're physically chased by a car following a kind of predetermined accelerating speed profile. And you have to get as far as you can get before the car catches you.
Yeah.
So I ended up, for me, that was an ultra marathon. It was always 2 weeks after London and I did about 60 odd kilometres and I was in the last few surviving people. I was beaten by Axel Finke. He outdid me. But that suited me very well. I have done longer ultras, but I've never done a great job of them. I've actually done a 100K UKA certified road ultra. Took 8 hours and, 12 minutes or something. That was really weird. It's like a full working day, just running continuously. I didn't even stop to go to the loo. It was so strange. But that was like 5 hours.
So that's at like 5 minute K pace the whole time, basically.
Something like that, except I was doing... If you look at my speed profile from the day, it's a classic blow-up. I was doing 7.5 minute miles for the first 5 hours and then dropping progressively to about 9 minute miles.
Right.
So I messed that up.
Yeah.
And I've done the Stour Valley Path 100K as well. Mm-hmm. Came third to Chris Kelly there the year I did it. But, you know, in general, these longer ultras, Pedder's Way as well, I don't really feel I've ever got right. I've always ended up in a bit of a pickle, blowing up. Maybe I haven't got my nutrition wrong or something, or maybe I just don't have the legs for it. So I think I'm not that cut out for the really long stuff. I've never tried 100 miles. And the longest I've ever run was when I did the Camino. So the...
Yes, I was going to come on to that. Yeah, Camino de Santiago, isn't it?
Exactly.
In northern Spain, in Galicia. Yeah, so how far did you go on that one then?
That was about 71 miles or something. So, the Camino, to me, we were going to stay in Santiago because my son was doing a language course there. And I'd read about it that, you know, there are these pilgrimage routes going into the city.
Mm.
And if you do the last 100 kilometres, you get a certificate. And it's a waymarked route. And I thought, that just says one day ultra to me. And it seemed that nobody else had the same idea. So I thought, I've got to do this. Which I did, but I had a few difficulties with the route having changed and my legs were a mess by the end, but I did do it. I can't remember how long it took, possibly about 12 hours or something. Anyway, but I was in a bit of a state by the end.
Did you go into the cathedral at the end? To...
I kind of bashed on the door, but it was 9 o'clock at night, so I don't think it's open. The bells were ringing as I got there. Yeah.
Is that one you would recommend?
Oh, totally, yeah. It was a good formula, actually. I think other people could do it. There are some... some sensitivities, because obviously most people do it for spiritual purposes. I'm not religious. Mm. And so I made it very clear that I wasn't doing it with any spiritual intent and I didn't want the religious certificate you can get, because that would be wrong, because, you know, it wouldn't apply to me. In fact, they didn't give me the 100K certificate. They started filling it out. And then when they understood that I'd done it in one day, they kind of deleted me with Tippex and said, I'm sorry, if you run it, it doesn't really count or something. It was the person on the day volunteering wasn't happy.
Because you haven't suffered for long enough.
Maybe, yes. I got another certificate, so with my name in Latin, so I have something to remember it by.
Ah, what's your name in Latin?
Carolum.
Carolum, there we go. Brilliant. So we've mentioned a few names from CNC as we've talked today. How have you enjoyed being part of Cambridge & Co? Obviously, it's got you the championship start, which was your original motivation, but have you... enjoyed being part of the club and the white and blue vest? Has that been a big part of things?
Well, yes and no. So what I have really enjoyed is doing races with people, you know, meeting up socially from time to time. Like, there's a pub crawl last week. You know, certainly having a crowd of people at the London Marathon and stuff, doing the inter-club races, you know, some of the Frostbite or what were the Kevin Henry races. So it's currently Arkwright. I've done a few of the cross-country championships, just the county ones or the Southerns sometimes. God, the Southerns are an amazing experience when you've got like a thousand people. Yeah. It's like the start of, it's like the battle scene from Braveheart or something. So all of that I really enjoy and I, you know, I still appreciate. But at the same time, I'm a complete hermit training wise. I went to the club for two training sessions in 2010 when I first joined the club, and never since. It just doesn't suit my lifestyle somehow. I suppose at the time I was influenced by having smaller kids who are now grown up and they don't care. But because my legs, you know, recover so poorly and I like to run my commutes, it would kind of dominate my whole week if I was to turn up for training sessions and want to get anything out of them. Mm. So all I ever do is kind of races and socialising with the club.
Yeah, but you're active, I think, on the website a bit as well, and you definitely identify as a CNC runner.
Oh, yeah. I do, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've obviously run a lot of miles in the Cambridge area, and you say you enjoy running by the river. Any tips for Cambridge runners to where to go for a nice long run if they find their current routes boring? Where would you send them?
Oh, gosh. Sometimes I've choose the most boring routes because I just want something predictable. So I've done... full marathons. In fact, I've done 50k training runs up and down the busway to St Ives.
Oh.
Just because it's completely predictable, it's smooth. There are even some toilets at Long Stanton Park and Ride.
I think the whole... that must be close to a marathon all the way there and back, isn't it? Is it just under?
From my house, it's actually 28 miles to St Ives Park and Ride and back. So from the start of the busway, it must be more like a marathon.
Yeah, there is
a Strava segment. Yeah, called the...
Is
the
it?
The Madman's Busway Ultra or something, and I've got that segment, I think. One of the few I can cling on to. But I love just running up and down the river because it's beautiful, it's flat, there are no traffic interruptions. It's obvious, but it's still great, you know, just...
Do you ever do the Ely run?
Just a couple of times, yeah. Quite early in my career, I kind of followed the route of the Turing Relays at the time, which was out to Ely, around the cathedral... back down the other side of the river and a loop round Jesus Green, which was just over 30 miles. So I have done that.
Easy to get lost near Upware, or between Upware and... There's a bit where the river sort of forks and you can't really tell where to go. I've gotten lost there before.
Yes, I had a buddy from work who ended up going to Reach by accident.
Yeah.
But remember, I'm a geek, so I'm a big believer in following a wiggly line in my watch using the GPX file. So, that's even for races where I think they're not going to be marshalled very well, I always try and get a GPX file so I know where I'm going, even if nobody else does.
That's good advice. I think most of us have gone wrong in a race some point.
Yeah, in ultras especially. You know, there are such talented people who just waste hours because they aren't going the right way. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And you mentioned you've got the two children and you've got your wife as well. Do they support you, or any of them, into running, or do they just think you're mad?
Oh, no. Well, actually... I would say they weren't, but just recently my wife and son have just completed Couch to 5K, and they've been doing some 5K runs on Midsummer Common because I figured out a 5K route you can do exactly. Mm-hmm. My daughter's done the odd park run as well in the dim and distant past, including here at Milton. In general, I don't ask them to come and support because I have grim memories of standing in windy, cold fields when my mum was doing races, and I didn't want to put them through that.
Oh.
But they... do always come for London because it's a nice day out. We meet up with some of my wife's university buddies. I get to go to two or three pubs. The time I felt most guilty for them, actually, it's all your fault, Ben. It was the Cambridge Half Marathon that I ran the fastest was in grim conditions. It was like driving hail or sleet, and I had two shivering children, a shivering wife at the end, because they had turned out, because it's so close to where I live. So they're certainly supportive, but I discourage them from turning out to support me.
And do you have a lot of running conversations at the dinner table in your house, or is it
not really
that into it?
No, I mean, they kind of know what I'm up to. I keep them appraised and, you know, say, well, I've got a race or whatever, but they just let me get on with it, really.
Yeah. Oh, nice. But obviously you do like getting into the nitty-gritty of things, the details, the routes, the gear, everything like this. So any tips more on... We talked about... scraping out your shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Any other tips on gear?
I was actually officially interviewed about this recently. There's a guy, Professor Nathan, I can't remember his surname, who's doing a study in the engineering department. And so I also showed him my shorts, which are modified. So I've got elastic loops in my shorts for holding gels, that I don't have to have any separate...
On the inside or outside?
Actually, on the outside.
On the outside, yeah.
I've also sewn extra pockets in so I can kind of carry extra stuff. In fact, I've got another prop... So, for the benefit of the listeners, I'm just getting a tiny little self-steel bag out of my back pocket. In there, this fits in my race shorts. So, if I'm just doing a park run or something, I can carry my big phone, which is relatively small by modern standards, in my Lycra shorts. But if I'm wearing my flimsy race shorts, I've got a little packet of stuff. So, I've got a tiny phone that looks like a kind of USB thumb drive. I think it's designed to be smuggled into prisons, to be honest. I'll leave it to your imagination as to how it will be smuggled into a prison.
No idea.
And some loo roll, my parkrun ID, some money.
So is that, that you can actually use that, you can actually make calls on that?
Absolutely, yes. So this tiny phone, it means...
What make is that?
Oh gosh, I can't even remember. No, it's some kind of... Long
so we're talking about two-thirds of a thumb size, maybe.
Exactly, yes.
This is amazing. Yeah, I mean, I think people would be quite reassured having that on them.
That's right.
Especially for ultra runs.
Yeah, and I've got a special SIM in it, actually. It's supposed to work on all networks. Also, I think this is partly because I was doing training runs in the Lake District all alone, and it's not without danger. You know, when I was doing that Bob Graham, I was climbing up the back of mountains and thinking, I'm so alone here. I'm in the dark. You know, I kept pinging my family when I knew where I was, but even so, it's quite risky. So I also carry a kind of emergency identity bracelet. So if something bad does happen to me, if they find my bloated corpse in a gully or want to scrape me off the road, they'll know who to call. So yeah.
That's reassuring.
Yeah. And I've got like a variety of rucksacks for mainly for commuting, but if I did an ultra.
Yeah, any particular ones that don't rub that you...
Yeah, my two favourite ones at the moment are OMM ones. Okay. So I've got like an 8-litre one for races that's only got a single buckle, so I quite like that. And there's a 10 or 12 litre one which I use for commuting, and I've used Innovate ones in the past as well.
Sock preference?
I've got, let me see, they're branded London, More Miles, they're by More Miles.
Oh, yeah.
And to be honest, it's probably just the association with the London Marathon which meant I chose them, but I do like them.
So you're not prone to blisters particularly or anything like
not
that?
Not really. No. In the past I was, when I was younger, and I mean, younger, 40s younger, and running fast races, I used to kind of erode patches of my forefeet and had terrible problems with blisters, but it doesn't seem to happen anymore, maybe because I just don't have that turn of speed anymore. I guess it's like shear forces going through your feet when they're kind of dragging you along. But yeah, I do put a bit of Vaseline in my socks if I'm doing like a big race, like a marathon or something.
And which are your current carbon shoes that you prefer now then?
So I've gone for the Next Percent, the Next Percent 2. Right. So yeah, so I'm wearing a Hacks pair, but I've got a fresher pair as well back at home.
And have you found that they've, I mean, these ones you've still got, but do you find they have a short lifespan or...?
They would have, especially because I land so terribly on my outer kind of midfoot. But I use this product called Shoe Goo, something that my mum did all
this
those years ago.
This is what for the extra grip as well?
Yeah, but I also use it to kind of build up bits of outer sole where I've worn it away.
So this is a black coloured, well, it comes out black anyway.
Yes, you can get a clear version as well. So it's this horrible foul smelling gloop. Yeah. And but it means that I can get, you know, hundreds of miles more out of my shoes, because otherwise that's a weak spot that would just get trashed so quickly.
Fantastic. T-shirt, obviously, if you're wearing your running vest, you don't tend to overdress, do you? You don't in races, I'm talking about.
No, certainly in races.
I think I've seen you with a vest where everybody else has got a long sleeve.
Oh yeah, well, to a certain degree. I mean, I do use arm warmers if it's like a frosty day, so that I can be in a vest. At race speed, one certainly does evolve a lot of heat, so it's not normally a problem getting cold. So I can kind of wind down my arm warmers. But I remember a Cambridge half, maybe it was that Cambridge half I was saying, when it was really cold, and I did wear long sleeves then, and I felt that gave me an advantage over other people who got too chilly. So I try and get it just right. So obviously I want to be cool in a race, but I don't actually want to get hypothermic. That's definitely not going to help, I think.
Yeah.
And in my commutes, I tend not to wear running tops. I wear cycling tops. And same at weekends, and that's partly because they've got a collar to keep rucksack straps off my neck, and partly because they've got back pockets where I can shove gloves and tops and things like that. So
I do the same sometimes. Fantastic. Right, any other areas of running geekiness that we haven't covered that you've really gone into?
Oh golly.
So we've done the shoes, the warmth,
the GPX plotting. I can't think of anything else. I mean,
When you finish a race and you look at the results, how long do you spend sort of poring over and looking at other people's performance? Are you into that, like comparing against others and percentages and all that sort of thing?
Oh, totally, yes. No, I'm always keen to know, you know, how the people have done, and just for myself, you know, what were my splits like? Was I blowing up? Did I have a bad positive split? Things like that. And increasingly, of course, I'm looking at age-graded percentages.
I was just going to say, do you hold by that quite a lot?
Yes, well, it's
do you think they're well done?
Yeah, I mean... Probably at the very top end, when you're like 95 years old or something, there just aren't enough performances to calibrate the system. So it probably doesn't work so well there. But otherwise, I think there are pretty you know, they're pretty much the fairest way you can compare.
Can I ask what's the highest number you've achieved on that? Do you know?
Well, I do. It's about 1% lower than you.
It was
84.6 or 7 or something.
Yeah.
And actually, on the Power of 10 database, it's not obvious, but you can list your performances in age-graded order instead of date order.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And my top one there was a half marathon, but my second was the 2018 London Marathon. And most people, I guess...
would rate that as a better performance, though.
Maybe, probably. Yeah, and I was going to say, most people wouldn't have marathons amongst their top performances because they tend to do better at short distances, but tend to fade in marathons.
Yeah.
Whereas I've got quite a few marathons up there because I'm not much of a performer at shorter distances.
But this is what I think is maybe an issue with it, that because perhaps, I don't know if it's more people do marathons, I don't know, at a top level, it seems to me that the marathon percentage is perhaps less flattering than it should be.
Yeah, no, I don't know, because for me, I have got a smattering of everything in that list. Mm. And I suppose I do the specialist thing of running these full marathons in training and stuff. You know, I give it my all for marathons in a way I don't for other distances.
Mm. So, and yet your half is your top one.
Yes, just. Yeah, that was up in Yorkshire, the Brass Monkey Half Marathon.
Yeah.
And it was one of those days where I just didn't know why it felt so easy. And I didn't understand why I was running so quickly at that heart rate. I just wish I could put that in a bottle and bring it back on other occasions.
Yeah, yeah, you do sometimes get those great days, don't you? Yeah. Do you, I mean, your slight build anyway, do you try and keep your weight down deliberately or anything like that?
Yes and no. I mean, I tend not to eat any junk food.
Mm.
And I do write down my weight and even a skinfold fat measurement frequently. So for the benefit of the listeners, I am 5'7" tall. My weight this morning, I think, was about 58 kilos.
Right.
So my BMI is about 20. But I've been surprised. Like that half marathon that was my best ever waiver score was in early January, just after Christmas, when I would have been 2 or 3 kilos heavier than normal. So
well, my Peterborough half marathon that we talked about, I was at one of my heaviest. Crazy.
That's right. So I think I'm already in the kind of optimal range, and it doesn't really benefit me trying to get any thinner. The weight does tend to drift down a bit during a marathon campaign just from all the miles. And I binge on fruit and nuts, so I may not be having cakes and biscuits, but give me a packet of sultanas or a bag of pistachios or something and I will demolish them. And that's like thousands of calories sometimes, I'm sure.
Fantastic. Right, well, we're getting near the hour, so we need to wrap up. But what have I missed? Any person you want to mention has been a great influence in your running career? And also then I've got to have my two stock questions that I always ask. Your favourite pre-race meal, or it can be just any meal if you prefer, and your favourite session.
Oh gosh, right. Okay, so in terms of people, I know I've name-checked a few people as I've gone along. I wouldn't know who else to pick out. I suppose I should thank my mum, because you get your mitochondria from your mother, and
there
she was the marathon nut who kind of influenced me, and Mr. Manson, that geography teacher.
Yeah.
So your other question, so pre-race meal...
the day before, or no? Because you're already cutting down, aren't you? So.
Yeah. Well, I've described what I normally do before a marathon, but it's not always possible if you're staying away from home and if it's not an A race. If I can't take my own sandwiches, then a big pizza the night before, and quite early in the day. I want to be, be fretting with my family saying, I want to eat before 6 o'clock, and
we want it all to go through, don't we?
And I've had some good results off some big pizzas. So, and you had one other question.
The session, like a favourite session. It's probably got to be the long run, has it?
Definitely. And of those, I think just a steady busway marathon is a classic. You know, a 7-minute mile marathon or something, which isn't that much slower than my marathon pace. When it feels right, it's just so rewarding. And I guess that's my go-to session.
Fantastic. Well, we're in a car here and it's now stopped raining, and I'm gradually getting hotter and hotter in it. But we do want to just want to finish. So if you want to follow Charlie, he's already mentioned his website. Let's have it one more time.
So it's www.wartonaby.org/running. And that links to my YouTube channel as well.
Brilliant. So if you are even a slight running nerd, I'd definitely recommend that. Anywhere else that to follow you on Twitter, aren't you?
I don't really use Twitter. I am on Facebook.
Facebook.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And how would you say people could recognise you if you were running around? You see, you've not gone totally aerodynamic, because Charlie's got quite a good crop of hair there, and a little goatee and a moustache going on.
That's right. Also, I run like a robot. My arm action is terrible. It looks like my arms are kind of frozen in place, quite low down. And it's not something I've ever been able to correct.
So if you see the picture that will go with this... podcast and you see someone like that, particularly if it's along the river, give them a wave, yeah, and a cheer. Because, last question, what's next?
Oh, gosh, always it's London. I mean, this autumn, unusually, I haven't got a marathon booked. I have booked the Cambridge Town and Gown 10K, which I've not done for years. Yeah. But that's I've already booked my hotel for London, even though I haven't even entered yet.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Right, well, it's been great talking to you, Charlie, and... if you go under 2:45 again, we'll get you back on.
I'm never going to do that. Come on, it's been a pleasure, Ben. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, I'll see what I can do.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Right, well, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Charlie Wartonby. I certainly did. Please do go and visit his website. There's plenty to get lost in there. And while you're searching around, why not come and look at our Facebook page, our Instagram, our Twitter. Follow us, rate and subscribe. And if you've got any suggestions of how we can improve, apart from the obvious, and if you've got any guests to suggest or want to help in any way, please just get in touch through any of those means. In the meantime, keep enduring.